This is Audible.
The Lying Kind. Detective Rachel Prince, Book 1. Written by Alison James. Narrated by Jan Kramer. Prologue. She stirred and stretched as the light in the room changed. Then she opened her eyes. The shiny light from the landing made everything look a different colour and played a shadow across the wall to her right. It was this that came into her head, waking her. There was someone in the room. At the exact second she opened her mouth to speak, a hand clamped down hard over it, silencing her. "Keep still. Don't move." She wriggled anyway, trying to free herself. "If you keep still, it won't hurt." There was a sharp stab, a pinching sensation. It was like when the nurse put the big needle in her arm at school. It hurt more than that time, though. "Keep still." She struggled. And then the world went first fuzzy, then black. Part 1. Not every puzzle is intended to be solved. Some are in place to test your limits. Others are, in fact, not puzzles at all. Vera Nazarian, The Perpetual Calendar of Inspiration. Chapter 1. Chirrup, chirrup. Chirrup, chirrup. You were supposed to sleep more lightly as you grew older, Rachel thought, her hand groping to shut off the chorus of crickets on her phone's alarm. But at 6:15 a.m., most mornings she still managed to be fast asleep, deeply asleep. She lay on her back for a few seconds, then hopped off the bed and performed some tentative stretches, switching on the TV news. An inset picture of a small, fair-haired child flashed up on the screen, zooming in on her face before cutting back to the newsreader. Surrey police have released a statement in reaction to criticism about scaling back their operation into the search for missing 6-year-old Lola Jade Harper. Detective Chief Inspector Clive Manners said, "We are keeping our existing lines of inquiry open and are reaching out to other agencies with a view to establishing new leads. Lola Jade disappeared from her mother's home in Eastwell, Surrey, at the beginning of May." Rachel switched off the TV, pulled on her Lycra running gear, and took the lift to the ground floor of the converted cotton warehouse, heading out into the still dozing streets of Bermondsey. A misty autumn morning was unfurling with the promise of a warm late October day to come. Rachel pounded the pavements of southeast London to the strains of Arcade Fire and The Killers. The damp in the air had left the cobbles near Tower Bridge covered in a greasy film, and as she slowed to change direction, she slipped, twisting her right knee awkwardly. The pain made her wince, but with plenty of adrenaline still coursing through her veins, she decided to push on or run back to her flat. It was only after she had showered and her body was cooling that her kneecap started to hurt in earnest. Rachel ignored it, changing into her preferred work uniform of black trousers and a plain white shirt. Standard plainclothes policewoman garb. She twisted her blonde hair into a ponytail, applied some subtle makeup, and viewed her reflection in the mirror. The woman looking back at her was tall, muscular, but narrow-waisted, and a little too flat-chested, in her own opinion. Nose a bit on the long side, but straight at least, large hazel eyes, decently shaped eyebrows. There were a few faint lines at the corners of her eyes, but otherwise she could still pass for 30 in sympathetic lighting. Could be worse, she told herself, then grabbed her bag and car keys. At 8:35, she parked her car in the underground car park of the National Crime Agency's headquarters near the South Bank and limped into the office. "All right, douchebag." Her detective sergeant, Mark Brickle, greeted her cheerily as she reached her desk. He seemed to be in good spirits today. When it came to Brickle, you never knew what you were going to get. He was distinctly moody and consistently rude, whether the mood was good or bad. They had first worked together for a year in serious organized crime after Rachel transferred there from the Metropolitan Police, then met up again when they both joined Interpol, before it became absorbed by the National Crime Agency. She liked him, And, more importantly, she trusted him, despite his occasional flakiness. He was too short to be her type. At 5'9", she preferred men to be at least 6 feet tall, but just about attractive enough for a joshing sub-flirtation to simmer between them. "Hold on," he said as she lowered herself onto her chair with painful slowness. "Don't bother sitting down. The boss wants to see us now." Deputy Chief Constable Nigel Patton was the Director of Major Crime Investigative Support, referred to as MCIS. The unit existed to provide expertise and advice to other law enforcement agencies investigating complex crimes. Both Rachel and Brickell acted as international liaison officers on MCIS, remaining stationed in London after Interpol's main UK operation had transferred to the northwest of England. Sighing, Rachel dropped her bag, grabbed a notepad, and followed Brickell to Patton's office. Although he was well into middle age, he had recently become a father again with his second wife. He was a careworn, prematurely bald man who had 2 teenage children with wife number 1 and had recently acquired a 3rd courtesy of the much younger wife number 2. Reading his screen upside down from where she stood in front of his desk, Rachel could see that he was online shopping for sporty-looking baby buggies. Danielle Patton, from what Rachel had seen of her at departmental functions, was exactly the sort to jog behind an all-terrain buggy containing a wobbling newborn while simultaneously checking her emails. She was a sinewy, fake-tanned marketing executive with perfectly groomed nails and hair and zero sense of humour. "D.I. Prince, D.S. Brickell, sit down, sit down." They sat. "Lola Jade Harper, you are familiar?" How could they not be? It was no coincidence that the case had been on the news that morning. Lola Jade Harper was still the UK's most high-profile missing child. A 6-year-old girl who had been taken from her bedroom in a home county suburb one spring night, and no one had seen her since. A child at the centre of a bitter custody battle, whose father had continued to protest his innocence of any involvement. The tabloids had feasted on every detail for the first few months, but now it seemed that public interest was starting to wane. "Surrey police are at a bit of a dead end," Patton affirmed, "but they've asked for our support following a recent development, which has not yet been disclosed to the press."
"Which is?"
"Surrey CID were working on the premise that the child was targeted and snatched to order. Neighbour's witness testimony supports this, as does the mother's, to an extent. But in the past few days, the girl's father, Gavin Harper, has completely disappeared. As you probably know, the parents are estranged, but family liaison officers were in frequent touch with them both. Only now Harper's no longer at his home address, and his family are claiming not to know where he is."
Patton raised his eyebrows to indicate scepticism.
"So, given there have been some reported sightings of Lola Jade abroad, and Gavin Harper has for no apparent reason done a bunk, the hope is that a couple of support officers with international experience, such as your talented selves, might be able to help. They went to Scotland Yard, but since it's not a Met-based case, Scotland Yard pushed it our way."
He smiled, in what he clearly hoped was a disarming fashion.
"Lazy Met tossers don't want the work, as per..."
Brickell caught sight of his superior officer's face and fell silent.
Patton pushed the hefty case file towards them. "I'll leave it to the two of you to get yourselves up to speed as soon as possible, and advise me on a list of actions. Obviously the media interest has been intense, so you'll have to think carefully about what information you release, and work closely with the press office. And you'll need to liaise with CEOP as well."
Patton trotted out the acronym for the NCA's Child Exploitation and Online Protection Command.
"You'll enjoy that then, Prince,"
smirked Brickell as they returned to the office.
"What's that?"
Rachel was lost in thought, specifically that the last thing she wanted to get involved in was a case that was simultaneously cold and high profile.
"Liaising,"
he made quotation marks around the word,
"with CEOP. That guy you fancy works there, Deacon."
"Giles Denton, and I don't bloody fancy him," insisted Rachel, who absolutely did.
Whatever. Brickle glanced at Rachel's awkward gait. You're looking even more of a spaz than normal. Why the gammy leg?
He loved to draw attention to Rachel's occasional fits of clumsiness. She didn't correct his insubordinate tone. She would never hear the end of it if she did. Instead, like the parent of a recalcitrant toddler, she picked her battles and only pulled rank when it was strictly necessary.
Twisted it running, it's no big deal.
She spoke with more confidence than she felt. The pain was building still further, and she was glad to sit down at her desk and take the weight off it.
What's the latest update on the file?
He flicked through the top few pages.
Couple of muggles phoning in with alleged sightings. Same shit, different day.
Brickle shrugged and slid the folder in her direction. Rachel started turning the pages, scan reading as much of the information as she could. Case activity was cooling, and Surrey Police CID had only made 2 new entries in the past month. A report that Lola Jade had been sighted on Fairfield Road, Eastwell, being led away by a dark-haired woman, and a child saying they'd seen Lola in the playground of their school. As Brickle had said, same old. Dozens of similar tip-offs had been followed up and still no Lola Jade. But someone knew what had happened to her. Someone out there knew. Their not-so-insignificant task was to work out who that was. After she had finished reading, she passed the file to Brickle again, but he declined to read it.
Sodding waste of time, if you ask me. The kid'll be dead.
Either way, we still need to find her. So what do you reckon we do first? Rachel reached discreetly into her bag and fished out some painkillers, downing them with water.
Brickle shrugged.
She gave him a hard look, suppressing irritation. Given the golden rule of detecting is to start with the closest relationships and work outwards, then it's a no-brainer. We talk to the mother. Let's aim to go down there tomorrow.
Okay, boss.
He gave a mock salute.
And while you're in subordinate mood, go and fetch me some coffee.
Brickle opened his mouth to protest, but she pointed to her knee and he relented, trudging off in the direction of the coffee machine. While he was gone, Rachel went into the ladies and carefully inched up her trouser leg. Her knee was swollen and throbbing, and the pain was intense. She had little time for the medical profession and hadn't been near a doctor in years. In fact, she made a point of avoiding them at all costs. But she was not going to be able to ignore this. Damn.
You come into the party tonight?
Brickle inquired, as he put the coffee down on her desk, slopping it over her paperwork.
Party? Hayley Snowden's leaving due. In one of the conference rooms.
Hayley was a member of the civilian operations support staff, about to transfer to a position in the Queen Street offices.
Yeah, maybe.
Rachel hauled herself to her feet. But right now I need to go and get this bloody knee sorted out. A private clinic near London Bridge obligingly offered Rachel an appointment that lunchtime. Being able to flash a warrant card helped, as did the health insurance policy for serving police officers. Her right leg was x-rayed, then she was sent to a different floor for an MRI. Finally, after waiting around 40 minutes, she was seen by an orthopaedic specialist.
"You say you are a runner, Miss Prince?"
he asked, looking at the images on his computer screen rather than at her face.
"Yes, I was running this morning when it suddenly started hurting." "Did you stop abruptly or change direction?"
Rachel nodded.
"Thought so."
He pointed to a white blur on the screen.
"You've torn your ACL, anterior cruciate ligament. It's a very common sports injury, especially amongst women. And you're 39,
he told her, as though she didn't know her own age.
"Your joints are not as resilient as they were 20 years ago."
Rachel ignored this. "Can it be fixed?" He turned from the screen and made eye contact at last.
"In severe cases, the ligament can be replaced with a tissue graft."
He met Rachel's dismay with a professional smile. "I don't think this is one of those cases. It should repair on its own eventually, but you'll need to rest it as much as possible."
"Will I be able to run?"
Rachel asked, as though she knew what the answer would be.
No exercise involving running, not for at least 3 months.
3? Rachel was horrified. Running was like breathing to her.
Look, I'll see you again in 6 weeks and we'll assess where we are then, and I'm also going to refer you for some physio. In the meantime, I sit and use painkillers as needed. I'll write you a script for some tramadol. If you need me to, I'll sign you off work.
Rachel shook her head firmly. Out of the question, I'm afraid.
We usually recommend crutches for a few days. Also out of the question.
By the time she had picked up her prescription from the pharmacy, it was late afternoon, and there was little point returning to the office. Instead, Rachel went back to her flat and changed into jeans, heels, and a floaty green top, taking down her customary ponytail and amping up the makeup. An hour later, she was in the first floor function room in the NCA's Tinworth Street headquarters, surrounded by balloons and a foil banner that read, "Sorry, you're leaving." A paper-covered trestle was laid out with boxes of cheap wine, plastic glasses, and an assortment of finger foods.
"You look nice, Rach."
Margaret, another of the unit's admin staff, enveloped her in an embrace that sloshed tepid white wine down the back of Rachel's top.
"Doesn't she hail?"
"She does," agreed Haley, resplendent in false eyelashes, mini-dress and skyscraper heels. "You look fantastic when you make a bit of an effort, ever so glam."
"You might even pull," added Brickle, with his mouth full of cocktail sausage, "though sadly there's no one from Child Protection here tonight."
"Oh," breathed Margaret. "Gossip, do tell."
Nigel Patton loomed into view, red wine in one hand, fun-size scotch egg in the other. He cleared his throat and brushed breadcrumbs from his chin.
"Haley, now might be the time for me to say a few words."
"Might be the time for a sharp exit, more like," muttered Brickle.
Rachel, struggling to balance her injured leg and heels, staggered slightly. Brickle caught her.
"Easy, tiger. Bit early for the falling down pissed act."
As she leaned on his shoulder and righted herself, her phone rang. She grabbed it quickly and held it at eye level to cut off the call before it interrupted Patton's speech. The call was followed within seconds by a text from the same unrecognized number. "This is Stuart Ritchie." Rachel jumped so violently in shock that she dropped the phone at Brickle's feet. He bent to pick it up, just as it stopped ringing, squinting at the text message.
"You're right, D.I. Prince. You look like you've seen a fucking ghost."
"I'm fine." She shoved the phone to the bottom of her bag.
"My knee's killing me, that's all. See you tomorrow."
Before he could say anything else, she grabbed her coat from the chair where she'd left it and hurried out of the room and down the stairs, the four words still jangling in her brain. "This is Stuart Ritchie." Outside the building, she leaned against the wall for a few minutes, catching her breath and waiting for the shockwave to subside.
Chapter 2.
There was no going for a run this morning, Rachel reflected miserably when she woke up. Her knee was still swollen and so stiff that she hobbled around her stylish kitchen, all exposed brick and brushed steel finishes, like a pensioner. Yet she managed to jump every time her phone buzzed. Exercise. She needed exercise to settle her jangling brain. If not running, then something else. She grabbed a swimsuit and a towel and drove to the nearest municipal sports centre to join the early morning lap swim in the chlorine tank that posed as a swimming pool. "I'll just do 10 lengths and then get out," she told herself. She ended up doing 40, and her head felt better for it. The mindlessness of it was soothing, but her knee joint was now screaming, and she'd probably done even more damage to it. On her way out of the building, she stopped and peered through the glass panel in the gym door, even though she was emphatically not the gym-going type. Everyone looked so busy and at the same time so vacuous, churning the pedals on their static bikes. The gym bunnies seemed universally bored, with the exception of the ones using the boxing punch bag hanging from a bracket in the far corner of the room. Now that did look like fun. A lot more fun than the physio her consultant had suggested. Rachel watched them for a couple of minutes before heading back to the car park.
As she sat down at her desk, wincing with the effort, her phone pinged. Hesitating, she checked the screen, wondering if it would be Stuart again. But it was a message from Mark Brickle.
Sorry, got hauled into Bogdani case conference. We'll have to do the Harper mother thing tomorrow.
The Bogdani case was an Albanian drug trafficking ring he had been investigating for the past 3 months. Sighing, Rachel composed a reply. Normally she would carry out an initial interview alone, but she was fairly confident that her knee would not permit her to drive to Surrey and back in heavy stop-start traffic. Any excuse, you lazy git, smiley face. I'll get reading and see what my spidey sense tells me. She hobbled to fetch coffee, then picked up the Lola Jade Harper file and started to read through it again. Looking for detail this time, and for whatever lay between the lines. Details were her detective lifeblood, the stuff that spoke to her instincts, things other people didn't even notice. She began with the initial missing persons report, filled out on a standard pro forma, dated 10th of May 2016. It gave the complainant's details as Michelle Harper, 57 Willow Way, Eastwell. Lola Jade was described as being 48 inches tall and weighing 58 pounds. Her hair was blonde, her eyes hazel, and her skin fair. She had no distinguishing marks, but her ears were pierced. There were no significant medical conditions, and her blood group was O positive. She was left-handed. When last seen at 9:15 p.m. on the 9th of May, she had been wearing lilac pajama bottoms and a pajama top printed with pink and purple butterflies. A photocopy of her birth certificate had been appended to the report, along with the copy of her registration as a pupil at St. Mary's C of E Primary, Eastwell. The further remarks box stated that Michelle Harper had phoned the emergency services at 6:47 a.m. on Thursday, 10th of May. She had gone into the child's bedroom to wake her for school and found the room empty. Lola Jade had no siblings, and her mother was currently living apart from her estranged husband. Rachel put in her headphones and listened to the 999 call.
Operator, which service do you require?
Police, please.
Hello, you're through to the police.
My name's Michelle Harper. My daughter's gone. She's been abducted.
And how old is your daughter?
She's 6, nearly 7.
Okay, can you tell me exactly what's happened?
Right. I put her to bed as normal last night, but when I went in to wake her this morning, she wasn't there. The bed was empty and the French window downstairs was open.
And you're sure she's not in the house? You've looked for her.
Of course I have. I've looked everywhere, inside and outside.
Are you at the property now, Michelle?
Yes. Where else would I be?
Okay, I want you to give me the address and an officer will be with you as soon as possible.
How long?
As soon as we can get a unit there. I'm contacting dispatch now.
Can you give me a rough idea?
I don't have an exact time, but it should be less than half an hour.
Rachel listened again, then a third time. It was unusual, she thought, that Michelle had stated straight away that Lola Jade had been abducted. Not that she couldn't locate her, or that she had disappeared, but that she had been abducted. Past publicity surrounding missing child cases had probably put that word into her mouth. That and watching too many TV crime shows. Her tone was tense rather than hysterical, but then Rachel knew from her years as a beat officer that there was a huge spectrum of reactions to grief and trauma. She looked at the photo of Lola Jade that Michelle Harper had supplied when the missing persons report was filed. It was a standard school headshot, and showed a plain, stolid child with long, mousy blonde hair, staring down the lens with a blank expression. In a more detailed statement given after Lola Jade had been missing for 2 days, Michelle outlined how she had put Lola to bed as usual the evening before she disappeared, and checked on her once after she had fallen asleep, and before Michelle herself went to bed, sometime around 9 p.m. There was no one in the house but Michelle, her daughter, and the family Pomeranian, the unfortunately named Diva. I went to bed at 10:30 p.m. At around 3 a.m, I was woken by a loud banging noise, followed by a scuffle coming from outside somewhere. I opened my curtains and looked out of the window.
I saw a man standing there a few yards from the front of the house. He was average height and build and wearing a hoodie pulled up. I couldn't see his face. I got back into bed for around 10 minutes, then looked out of the window a second time. The man that I had seen was gone. It was quiet, so I got back into bed and fell asleep until 6:30.
Elsewhere in the file, among the statements taken from neighbours during the door-to-door, a Mr. Stephen Arnold had said that he had seen two men, one of whom was short and of slight build, the other bigger, hanging around the close earlier on the 9th. He described their demeanour as shifty. Another neighbour, Anna Wozniak, reported seeing a white transit van with its engine idling parked around the corner from Willow Way. It was too dark for her to read the number plate. Michelle's husband, a self-employed builder called Gavin Harper, had been cooperative when police first spoke to him, but adamant he knew nothing about his daughter's disappearance. But fast forward a few months and he had vanished, with no one, including his own family, apparently knowing where he was. If they were telling the truth. The behaviour seemed too unusual to be mere coincidence. Yes, after such a stressful period, anyone might want to take off for a while, gain some distance, clear their head, but not without telling their nearest and dearest where they were going. Questioned further, Michelle had admitted that Gavin could be aggressive, although he had no criminal record other than petty motoring offences. There was a statement from Sonia Kenny, Michelle's mother, corroborating her daughter's claims but being vague about the detail, only able to offer that Gavin had shouted and thrown stuff on a few occasions, and after one argument, she couldn't remember exactly when, he had pulled Michelle's hair so hard that some of it had come out in his hand. From the look of Michelle's elaborate extensions and hair pieces, that could easily happen, Rachel concluded. After standing up and limping around the perimeter of the office to ease the stiffness in her right leg, Rachel read through the forensic report and looked at photos the SOC officer had taken at Michelle's house. Lola Jade's bedroom was an explosion of sugar pink and stuffed toys, exactly as you would expect for a girl her age. There were DVDs on a shelf on the wall, a small TV and a CD player, but no books in evidence. The bed was slightly rumpled, the duvet in its frozen-themed cover folded back. On the rug next to the bed was a white stuffed bear wearing a garish pink lurex dress that Michelle had said was Lola Jade's favourite. Apparently she'd never go anywhere without her Katy Bear, named after Katy Perry. Tiny spots of blood were found on the pillowcase, and this was confirmed to be Lola's when compared with the DNA from her toothbrush, although puzzlingly the amount was not enough to be consistent with a significant injury. There was also a trace amount of blood found on the rug and, significantly, DNA that was a familial match to Lola Jade but did not belong to Michelle. Following a search of the property where Gavin Harper had been living, detailed in a statement by a DS Rajavi, a second forensic report confirmed that the DNA in Lola Jade's bedroom belonged to her father. This made Rachel's hackles rise, and she highlighted the relevant paragraph in the file. Without reading further, she put in her headphones and played the video file of the original press conference held by Surrey Police. Michelle Harper sat between a heavy-set woman with dyed pink hair and DCI Clive Manners. Katy Bear clutched on her lap, shifting in her seat. Shock had finally set in, and her demeanour was quite different to that of the assertive woman on the 999 call. She seemed shrunken, cowed, but not pale, thanks to the copious fake tan and bronzer she was wearing. Her fingers were tipped with acrylic talons, and her eyelashes were as heavy as a pantomime cow's. She dabbed at her eyes with a tissue and turned frequently to glance at the pink-haired woman for reassurance. Checking through the transcript and some of the press cuttings, Rachel discerned that pink hair was Michelle's older sister, Lisa Urquhart, who lived in the Eastwell area. DCI Manners had emphasised how his force were doing everything in their power to find Lola Jade, and appeal to people in the local area to come forward with information. No matter how unimportant it may seem to you, it could help with the investigation. The usual guff.
Then Michelle herself spoke. She did not make eye contact with the camera, choosing instead to hang her head and look down at her lap.
"Whoever's got Lola Jade, please, please just bring her back. That's all I want. I just want her brought back safe."
She rubbed her eyes with a tissue. Then Clive Manners shepherded her away with his hand on the small of her back. There was also footage of an interview with Michelle filmed in her home a few days later by the local independent news channel. Her makeup was freshly done, her extensions artfully arranged, and she seemed calmer. Rachel paused the VT and scrutinized the living room. Michelle was seated on a squashy cream leather sofa, and there was a matching cream armchair to her right. In between the two was a gilt side table with an ashtray containing a few lipstick-stained butts and the ash from the cigarette that Michelle was smoking during the interview. The wall behind her was covered with a montage of family photographs, mostly babies and toddlers, and its centerpiece was a huge gilt-framed studio portrait of Lola Jade, aged about 3 or 4, wearing a shiny white dress that wouldn't have looked out of place at a gypsy wedding, and leaning awkwardly on a plastic Doric column in a white satin landscape. Rachel pressed play.
"Lola's my absolute world. She means everything to me."
She's going to use the P word, thought Rachel. Women like her couldn't help themselves.
"She's just my little princess, my angel. Princess Angel, that's what I call her."
Michelle dragged greedily on her cigarette, her fingers trembling. In only a few days she had lost some weight. The not-quite-pretty face was drawn and her clothes were loose.
"I know this must be terribly hard for you," the interviewer said, dropping her voice to the hush of professional concern.
Michelle dropped her face into her hands to cover her sobs, sending a flutter of ash onto the carpet.
"I just want things back to how they were, you know? No one can be expected to cope with this. It's literally like being in a nightmare."
She gathered herself and went on to talk about how a group of friends and neighbours had been organising their own search efforts locally, working through brownfield sites and open heathland. Someone else had started a Find Lola Jade page on Facebook. Rachel booted up her desktop monitor and immediately found the page online. The profile picture was the same studio shot of Lola in the white satin dress. The most recent post was by someone called Tanya Dickerson. "Our Lola Jade still missing, even though Surrey police have randomly decided to downgrade the case," ! "So wrong, babes," as Stacey Fisher had commented. There was a link to a Just Giving page. Rachel clicked on it. The total raised stood at £47,963. Returning to the paper file, she flicked through the sheaf of witness statements taken during the investigation. They represented a lot of footwork on the part of uniformed officers, but had thrown up precisely 0 new lines of inquiry. Nobody had seen or heard anything unusual at 57 Willow Way the night that Lola Jade disappeared, and family, friends and neighbours all claimed they knew nothing. A brick wall of silence, despite the substantial reward offered by one of the tabloid newspapers. Rachel flicked back to the description of the hoodie man that Michelle claimed to have seen and sat staring at that paragraph for a few seconds. Then she phoned the main switchboard for Surrey Police and asked to speak to DS Leela Rajavi. "Did you ever meet Gavin Harper?" Rachel asked, once she had introduced herself and the professional niceties had been dealt with.
"Yes, I did the first interview with him."
"And his alibi for the night Lola Jade went missing?" "Said he was at home in his flat all night. There was no one who could corroborate either way. Also..."
"Go on."
"Well, Gavin Harper does have form. He once failed to return his daughter after a routine access visit. Couldn't be contacted for around 24 hours. A bit of a dry run, perhaps, testing the waters. In retrospect, it does look significant, yes."
Rachel absorbed this. "And how would you describe him, physically?" hard to say. Ordinary looking, average height, average build.
In other words, exactly like the man on the street the night Lola Jade was taken.
The second she had hung up, Rachel's mobile rang in her hand. An unknown number. The same unknown number, Stuart's.
She snatched it off her desk, switched it off and hurled it into her bag as though it was a grenade.
Then, for a few moments, she sat with her head dropped and her face buried in her hands, telling herself that if she didn't look, it wasn't happening.
Chapter 3.
So, who is he?
Brickell hit the horn of the pool car hard as he negotiated one of London's overused A-roads, attempting to head south. It was morning rush hour, and the lanes were snarled with buses, vans, bikes and jaywalking pedestrian commuters. Rachel, right leg propped awkwardly in the angle of the seat well, pretended she hadn't heard him. Instead, she reached into her bag and pulled out a blister pack of Tramadol, swallowing a couple with the cooling takeout coffee in the cup holder.
Brickell persisted. "Whoever phoned you at the party, who is he? Or she? I mean, your face. You went white as a sheet."
"No one."
"Must be someone if you were that freaked out."
Rachel gave a wry smile. "What are you, a detective?" He cruised to a stop at another of the interminable traffic lights and turned to face her.
"So?"
She kept her head turned away. "Just an ex, that's all." Brickell raised his eyebrows slightly, but before he could ask any more questions, Rachel had inserted her headphones and closed her eyes. Willow Way was one of a handful of roads on a private estate to the southwest of the dormitory suburb of Eastwell. They were all named after trees, Birch Close, Ash Crescent, Sycamore Drive, and when construction had taken place in the early 90s, an abundance of trees had been planted to reinforce the point. The buildings now looked dated, but the trees had matured to give an air of suburban comfort. They were modest houses in linked pairs and small terraces, blocks of three or four homes aimed at young families and junior executives. Tidy, but not aspirational. Brickell parked outside number 57, and they both took in the property before getting out of the car. The front garden was laid to lawn, and it looked as though it could do with the attentions of a mower. Most of the neighbours had added hanging baskets and large pot plants. Michelle had none. There were no children's bicycles and toys as there were in front of the other houses. But the house seemed well maintained, and the windows were clean. They walked up the path and rang the bell. Silence. No dog barking, no footsteps, no sound of a radio or television. Rachel rang again, then peered through the window into the open-plan living and dining room. No signs of life, no lights on. In the kitchen, which she could just glimpse through the arch at the back of the room, the countertops were clear of any of the detritus of daily life.
"What do you reckon?" asked Brickell.
"Looks like she's gone away. Given what's happened, I can't really blame her."
"Would have been nice to know that before sitting in traffic for over an hour."
Brickell vaulted over the side gate and disappeared towards the back of the house, re-emerging a couple of minutes later, shaking his head.
"Nada, not a fucking sausage."
"Good job I brought the file with me, then. Her number will be on the contact sheet. I'll phone her." As soon as the call was picked up, she recognised the defensive tone from the emergency call.
"Who is this?"
"Michelle, this is D.I. Prince from Investigation Support at the National Crime Agency in London. I'm at your address, hoping to have a quick word. Are you around?"
There was a brief pause.
"I'm out shopping."
"When will you be back?"
"No idea. An hour, maybe?"
After telling Michelle that they would wait,
Rachel and Brickell parked at the nearest parade of shops and found a cafe. Brickell ordered his usual, a full English with the works. Rachel took the file out of her bag and continued reading it.
"Just double-checking for more info on the father," she told Brickell as he dipped a sausage into egg yolk. "Want to get the facts before we ask Michelle about him."
Gavin Harper had been named as a person of interest at the start of the inquiry into Lola Jade's disappearance. After her phone call to Leela, Rachel had checked the PNC nominals file, and sure enough, earlier that year,
he had been cautioned for violating a court order relating to shared custody following an allegation made by Michelle Harper.
"He's got to be the most likely culprit," she told Brickell. "Gavin Harper. He tried to snatch her before, apparently."
"Divorced dad syndrome," Brickell observed through his mouthful of fried food. "Using the kid to get at the ex is classic stuff."
Other than that, there were just a few traffic offences and a very minor public order offence when Gavin Harper was a teenager. According to the file, a blue notice had been issued on Interpol's database requesting any information about his whereabouts, along with a statutory yellow notice aimed at locating missing minors. If he had left the country after the notice had been issued, then his name would automatically have been flagged up at border crossings, airports, and anywhere else where passports would have been checked. The notices had been issued on the morning of 20th of October, after local officers had attempted to re-interview Gavin Harper and been unable to find him. If he had been travelling with his daughter, the chances of no one spotting them and reporting it were virtually zero. Not now that Lola's face had been on the front page of the papers for months. Among the raft of paper statements was an alleged sighting of Lola Jade in Brussels and another in Portugal, both around a week after her disappearance. Officers from the Surrey force had flown to Belgium and to the Algarve to investigate these claims, but had drawn a blank. A few more such sightings were reported in the weeks that followed, but it had been decided that they would only be actively pursued if substantial evidence came to light. It did not. Local sightings had also failed to throw up any concrete leads. Sniffer dogs and divers in the local quarries and reservoirs had drawn a blank. After 20 days with no sightings of the child, a cadaver dog had been through Lola Jade's home but found no evidence that she had died there. Inevitably, as weeks had turned into months, Lola was demoted from front page headlines to the inside pages as the fickle public started to move on. When Brickell had finished his breakfast and they had both drunk their coffee, they returned to Willow Way. This time, there was a white BMW hatchback parked outside the house. The front door opened after the first ring. When Brickell held up his warrant card, the woman pulled the door fully open and stepped inside, indicating that they should come in. They followed her into the living room. Michelle Harper wore tight white jeans and a T-shirt with a designer logo. Her toenails and fingernails were immaculately painted, and her hair, no longer blonde but a nut brown, looked as though it had recently been professionally blow-dried. She did not offer tea or coffee, but indicated that the two of them should sit on the armchairs that matched the cream sofa. The room was tidy to the point of sterility, and although photos of Lola Jade still graced the wall, there were few other reminders of her in the room.
"I'm D.I. Rachel Prince, and this is D.S. Mark Brickell. As I told you over the phone, we're from the National Crime Agency. We..."
"National?" Michelle interrupted. "So you're nothing to do with Surrey Police?"
"No, I'm... we're the investigation support team reviewing your daughter's case."
"So Surrey Police aren't bothering with Lola anymore?"
Michelle blinked hard, reached for a tissue and gave her eyes a quick wipe.
"Sorry, can't help getting emotional when I talk about her."
She pulled a packet of cigarettes from her bag, lit one, and then cast around for an ashtray. Unable to find one, she took the plastic saucer from under a fake orchid and used that to collect the accumulating ash.
"They've given up on her. I knew it."
"It's not that they're not bothering. It doesn't work like that," Brickell explained. "They'll pass on any new leads, of course, and we'll liaise with them in return, but they haven't got officers out there looking for her at the moment, no."
Michelle's face wore an unreadable expression.
"They reckon she's dead. It's obvious. And I keep telling them, how can she be when it's Gavin that's done this? He's organised it somehow. I don't know how, but he's done it. It will be absolutely typical of him."
Rachel attempted what she hoped was a reassuring smile.
"Nobody's suggesting Lola Jade's dead. We're very much working around the possibility of finding her alive. We wouldn't be getting involved if that possibility didn't exist. And obviously we will be looking very closely at your ex-husband."
Michelle nodded, and even managed a brief smile as she pushed out a stream of smoke through collagen-plumped lips.
That's all well and good, but no offence, Surrey Police have been telling me the same thing, and 5 months down the line we're no closer.
Brickell leaned to one side to avoid the plume of smoke.
What makes you so sure it was your ex-husband?
Because she didn't cry out. If she'd woken up and there was a stranger in her room, she'd have screamed the place down. She made a racket even if she had a bad dream. But there was nothing. Whoever took her, she went with them willingly. So it has to be Gavin. Who else?
She flicked a tube of ash from her cigarette.
And by the way, he's not my ex. We're still married. That's the point. He was afraid of losing custody of Lola Jade in the divorce.
Can you think of anyone else who might know where Gavin's gone?
Michelle pursed her lips.
Well, his family, his dad and his brother. They say they don't know, but...
She let this hang for a while, then stubbed out her cigarette and pressed her hand to her forehead.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to go. I'm getting a migraine. Talking about Lola Jade brings them on. It's the stress.
Rachel started to speak, but Michelle buried her face in her hands, drooping like a flower.
Sorry, I can't. I just can't.
Talk to the hand,
sniggered Brickell as they headed back down the drive.
Bloody Nora, she's a fragile little thing, our Michelle, isn't she?
Hardly, scoffed Rachel. But there's no point badgering her at this point. We need to try and find Gavin Harper, who sounds a right piece of work.
So you're up to speed on the file,
said Brickell as he swung out of the housing estate and rejoined the London Road.
Do you think he did it?
I'm going to go back and reread his statement, that's for sure. Rachel's tone was careful, but Brickell knew she was forming a hunch. Think about it. He's the one with a motive for taking Lola. Plus, he previously violated a custody agreement, in effect abducting his own child, however briefly.
But,
Brickell persisted, if he managed to take her out of the country with him when he left, then where has she been since May? And would they not have been spotted, given her face has been on the front page of every paper?
He could have managed it if he snatched her and handed her straight over to someone else before Michelle raised the alarm. Someone who took her abroad for him and kept her hidden there until he could join her. Or what if Gavin Harper's taken her but hasn't gone abroad? They could be hiding somewhere in this country.
Assuming she's alive, pointed out Rachel. But you know the statistics. 90% of missing kids are found within 72 hours. Of the remaining 10%, the vast majority turn up within 3 weeks, most of them in body bags.
Either way, we'll need to speak to Michelle again at some point, said Brickell firmly. We were only just getting warmed up.
Agreed, Rachel nodded. We're definitely not done with the lovely Michelle.
Chapter 4
Howard Davison lived boxing. When he wasn't hitting a punch bag, he was teaching other people to hit it, and when he was at home, he watched boxing on TV as often as his wife would allow it. It showed in his body, which was top-heavy, with a thickly muscled neck and shoulders. Sweat was gathering on his sunbed-browned face and soaking through the back of his vest.
"Stand with your legs apart like this, arms at shoulder height, then shoot out your right arm."
He thwacked the punch bag.
"Like this."
He stepped off the mat.
"Your turn,"
he told Rachel. She shuffled forward on her injured knee, twisted awkwardly and landed a feeble punch on the bag, losing her balance as she did so.
"You have to get the stance right, or you're not going to have enough power. Legs apart, with right leg back. Keep the tension in those legs, like you're about to kick a football."
Rachel grimaced at him.
"Difficult when one of your legs isn't working. And comparing stuff to football is never going to help. My sergeant's obsessed with it. I know nothing."
Howard grinned, creasing the corners of his piercing ice-blue eyes. His buzz-cut hair was an indeterminate mousy colour, not quite short enough to hide the beginnings of grey around the temples. Rachel had signed up for some personal training with him when she realised that swimming was making her knee worse. She calculated that a sport where you keep your lower body largely still and moved your upper body would work for someone with a torn ligament. But it wasn't proving that easy. She still needed to move her feet,
and she'd had to sweet-talk Howard into taking her on at all in her current condition.
Okay, Rachel, keep your chin down. Chin up is just begging to be hit.
By a punch bag?
The stance should be the same, even with no live opponent. Now try a double jab. 1-2.
Rachel flailed ineffectively at the bag.
Problem is what you're wearing.
Howard indicated the baggy sweatshirt, hanging loosely over equally baggy tracksuit bottoms.
It's getting in your way. Next time try wearing a vest and shorts. It'll be much better.
Rachel raised an eyebrow. Really? You want me in school PE kit?
Howard laughed. Hey, it doesn't matter what you look like. I train people of all shapes and sizes, and I'd say you're in better shape than most of them. Now, try it again. I know your right knee's an issue, but try keeping the tension in those legs. Both arms, shoulder height. That's it.
Rachel landed a couple of more convincing punches on the bag. Then again. Adrenaline coursed through her body, just as it used to years ago when she was a cop on the beat. It felt good.
When you mentioned your sergeant, Howard said as she eventually collapsed breathless on a weights bench, does that mean you're in the military?
Police, I'm a detective.
Howard raised his eyebrows a fraction.
The boxing will come in handy then, when you come up against a villain.
Rachel was about to explain that the NCA's role was mainly one of oversight and intelligence gathering, and that she spent the majority of her time driving a desk, but thought better of it and buried her sweaty face in her towel. After all, she was a trained firearms officer and very occasionally took part in tactical operations.
I think we ought to stop now. I don't want to overdo it and make my leg worse.
Howard smiled.
To be honest, I'm still not sure you should be doing this at all. But if you build up strength in your quads and your abs, it will help your injury in the long run.
That's the plan. Rachel gave him a sweaty high five. You don't get rid of me that easily. Back in the office, she flicked a rubber band at Brickle, who was engrossed in checking Premier League results on his computer terminal.
Oi, deadbeat, I've been thinking.
Careful, you know how dangerous thinking is.
He didn't look away from the screen, but flicked the rubber band back at her.
I think I should go and talk to Michelle Harper on my own. Maybe I'll get more out of her woman to woman.
Brickle made a scoffing noise. Whatever.
He pointed at her knee. What about your gammy leg? Thought you couldn't drive that far. I'll get a bobby to drive me, but ask the questions on my own.
Brickle shrugged. Worth a try, I suppose. Only make sure she's in, save wasting everyone's time.
2 hours later, WPC Wendy Nichols parked outside number 57 Willow Way and cut the engine. A council refuse truck was lumbering its way round the street, with the bin men snatching and tipping the contents of wheelie bins. Michelle's bin wasn't out, Rachel noted.
You want me to wait here, Mum?
Rachel nodded. Shouldn't be too long. I phoned to say I was coming. Once she'd struggled out of the passenger seat, she stuck her head back into the car and said,
And while I'm inside, go into the back garden and see what's happened to the bins. Take some photos.
Oh, and hold on a sec.
She took Wendy's empty paper coffee cup. I'm going to need this. Michelle Harper opened the door wearing a grey velour tracksuit and sheepskin boots studded with diamante.
Come in, Rebecca.
Rachel.
Yes, sorry.
She hovered as Rachel lowered herself into an armchair, placing the takeout cup next to her on the side table, as though she was still drinking from it. Michelle perched herself on the very edge of the cream sofa, not acknowledging Rachel's injury, so that she felt she had to.
Running accident.
Michelle ignored this.
Look, I'm obviously going to do all I can to help you.
She hesitated, checking her own attitude, and added,
But I'm going out of my bloody mind with the stress. It's still literally giving me migraines. I've already told Manners and the Asian girl everything I can remember, multiple times.
Rachel gave her best professional smile.
Just a few more questions, if you don't mind. We didn't exactly have a proper chat last time.
Sorry, but like I said, the migraines, I can't help it.
Michelle adopted a self-pitying expression as she reached into her bag for her cigarettes and lit one.
"We'll take it slowly."
Rachel decided the best approach was to ignore the histrionics.
"Let's start by talking about your life before this happened. How long was it since you and your husband had split up?"
"A year and a half, roughly. Bit longer, maybe."
"And what was your relationship like during that time?"
"Things were okay to start with, but he started bringing Lola back late on his access days, and then he abducted her."
Michelle's tone was oddly impassive.
Rachel nodded. "I've been wanting to talk to you about that. What happened exactly?"
"He was supposed to bring her back one Saturday evening, and he didn't. Wouldn't answer his phone. Kept her all day Sunday without a word. I was going out of my mind, literally losing it. I ended up calling the police."
Michelle puffed smoke at the ceiling.
"And how about when you were together? How were things between you then?"
"Well, you know."
"No, I don't know. That's why I'm asking."
The self-pitying look appeared again. "He used to knock me about."
"And this was reported to the police?"
Rachel had read the whole file, so she already knew the answer to this question.
Michelle shook her head. "No, it wasn't. No point. You know how it is. You lot aren't interested in domestics."
"And what did he used to do exactly?"
Michelle picked up her phone, opened her photos app, and started scrolling through the pictures. When she found what she was looking for, she thrust the phone in Rachel's face.
"Look."
The photo was of the inside of a forearm, or wrist, it was hard to tell, swirled with bruising in shades of vivid magenta and lemon yellow. She flicked to another close-up of what looked like a neck and shoulder smeared with livid scratch marks.
"Can I see?"
Rachel reached for the phone to get a closer look, but Michelle snatched it away and put it back on the side table. Rachel let this go, for now.
"And how was he with Lola Jade?"
"Pretty good on the whole. She was a real daddy's girl, adored her dad. Like I said last time, that's why she'd always have gone with him without question. She'd have thought the whole thing was a bit of a game."
"So where do you think Gavin could be now?"
There was a pause while Michelle subjected her cigarette to a long, intense drag. There was a clean ashtray on the table this time. Rachel was longing for a drink, but no offer was made, presumably because of the empty coffee cup.
"Come on, you must have a theory. Your daughter vanishes, and then so does your ex, 5 months later? After you say he'd previously attempted to take her?"
"Oh, don't worry. I know exactly where he'd go. He'll have gone back to Spain. He worked in a bar in Torrevieja for a while when he was younger, as a package holiday rep for a bit, then at the Asturias bar, and he was always banging on about how he wanted to go back, wanted me and Lola to move out there too, said it would be a great childhood for her, growing up in the Mediterranean sun."
She sucked on her cigarette savagely. "But I said no."
"Have the police followed that up?"
Michelle curled her lip.
"They just said they were looking into all relevant lines of inquiry. But they never found anything."
Smoke escaped from her mouth as she spoke.
"Apparently."
"But you think Torrevieja could be a good starting point?"
"Definitely. He'd have taken her there. If it is him that's done this, and I can't see who else it would be."
Rachel waited for Michelle to elaborate, but she simply flicked up her cigarette and stared vacantly ahead.
"And what about other people who came into close contact with Lola Jade? Other adults in her life, relatives, her friends' parents, babysitters?"
Michelle shook her head firmly.
"I never used babysitters. I didn't like leaving my princess with strangers. I liked her with me. The odd time she needed minding, she'd go to my sister Lisa's."
Michelle thought for a moment.
"I know when she was with Gav, if he needed to go out somewhere, he'd leave her with his cousin Tony. Tony and his wife Joyce."
"Their surname?"
asked Rachel, pen poised over her notebook.
"Ingram. They didn't have kids of their own, and they adored Lola. Every time she went to there, she'd come back with a present, usually just cheap rubbish."
Michelle screwed up her nose to indicate distaste.
"Any chance of a cup of tea?"
"Sure, sorry."
Michelle gave a non-sorry smile as she ground the butt into the ashtray and headed into the kitchen.
"Okay if I have a look around?"
Rachel called after her. Michelle was filling the kettle and taking mugs from the cupboard.
"Course, go ahead. Let me just get rid of this."